What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Richard Agler, author of the new book, The Tragedy Test, Making Sense of Life-Changing Loss. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Too Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, plus our young Shin Shin Yot, Ron Benicote, and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's the Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, and at a time when Americans are again struggling with issues of racism and racial inequality, it's important to remember the moment of history in which Dr. King came to prominence, the 1950s and early 1960s. At that time, much of America was segregated, and the South was famously racist. It was a time when the concept of a black American president was impossible to imagine. When future President Barack Obama was born in 1961, there were Jim Crow facilities all through the American South. Most blacks couldn't vote in the South. There were segregated bathrooms, segregated restaurants, segregated buses, and on, and separate by no means meant equal. Schools throughout the North, that's the North, folks, were also segregated, although perhaps less obviously so, but still, with blacks and whites, in effect, attending different educational institutions of very different quality. In large parts of America, African Americans had to sit in the back of the bus, drink from separate water fountains, use toilets outside the building, eat in different restaurants, stay in inferior hotels. In 1968, when Obama was 7 years old, he and I are the same age, so I remember this, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death by a white racist in Memphis, precipitating race riots throughout the country. Changes occurred because of the civil rights movement, because of the courage of the marchers at Selma and throughout the South, and the support of a free press and principled white and black activists who sometimes paid with their lives. Some of them who did were Jewish. Things began to change, but it took time for real transformation to happen. Many whites and many Jews marched with King, inspired by words of his when he wrote, "When Moses walked into the courts of Pharaoh and thundered forth with the call to let my people go, he introduced into history the concept of a God who was concerned about the freedom and dignity of all his children. Active in the affairs of men, struggling relentlessly against the forces of evil that beset them, seeking to mold a people who will serve as his children, as partners, in the building of his kingdom here on earth." Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel famously wrote a letter to Dr. King after marching with him in Selma. In it he said, "Even without words, our march was worship. I felt like my legs were praying." King understood that racism against one minority is racism against all minorities, that vicious, bigoted hatred must be resisted solely because it is wrong. And Dr. King said so.
"My Jewish brothers and sisters said to me amid anti-Semitism anywhere, we don't need your support. We have enough Jewish power to deal with this problem ourselves. I would still take a stand against anti-Semitism because it's wrong, it's unjust, and it's evil. If my Catholic brothers and sisters said to me, amid bigotry toward Catholics, we don't need your support in this because we have enough Catholic power to deal with it, I would still take a stand against bigotry toward Catholics because it is wrong, it is evil, and it is unjust."
You know, we Americans have strange attitudes about race to this day. Our previous president was a black man of these same United States. He was elected twice in a row to the highest office in the land by a majority of the American electorate. He held the most powerful position in the world for 8 years. That is the kind of fact that proves America is indeed the land of opportunity. But this is also the land in which the next president, Donald Trump, spent years pretending Obama was born in another country, falsely claiming he wasn't a real American. And many Americans somehow believe this claptrap, and it's possible that some still do. Racism comes in many forms. It was notable in the 2016 election campaign and in the months between Trump's election and inauguration and in the 2 years, almost exactly, since he was inaugurated, there has been a significant uptick in racist incidents throughout our country. In the summer of 2017, the Charlottesville racist rally, which was deeply anti-Semitic, demonstrated that there is still a vicious strain of race hatred that crawls out from under rocks and kills people. And the level of racism available for easy viewing on the internet every single moment of the day is horrifying. Dr. King spoke out against all biases vigorously, including anti-Semitism. We Jews are acutely attuned to that prejudice and need to be so in a period of rising anti-Semitism. The horrific anti-immigrant rhetoric that has focused viciously on Latino asylum seekers and economic migrants and demonized people in the most vicious and opportunistic ways is provoking violence and death right now. These are truly awful expressions of racism, frighteningly prevalent in our country today. And we still need to know that anti-African-American racism remains very much an American problem, even now, more than 50 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. The work of combating these biases and hatreds belongs to all Americans, really all people, of good conscience and moral fiber. It is all of our problem in America, and this King weekend should remind us that it's not a long-solved historical problem from the past. It is with us now, and, my friends, we have work to do. To play us in on this King weekend morning, here's a setting of a beautiful passage from the Talmud. Because of my brothers, sisters, and friends, Leman Achai V'Re'ai, out of the house of God I say peace to you. Leman Achai, in a setting by Yitzhak Rosenthal, performed by Shalsheles, sung with the Maccabees. Leman, Leman, Leman Achai, Achai V'Re'ai. Ah. That was Laman Achivarei, sung by the a cappella groups Shalshelis and the Maccabees. Because of my brothers and sisters and friends, I say peace to you of all races and backgrounds, of all origins. This is the house of God. I seek the best for you. Amen. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Richard Agler, a friend and colleague who suffered the tragic loss of a child. How he dealt with that loss, how we can learn from his experiences and thoughts, and what we should and shouldn't do when consoling others in that terrible place are the subject of his new book, The Tragedy Test, Making Sense of Life-Changing Loss. It's great. Meet him when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Richard Agler is a colleague and friend, a congregational rabbi for many years, and most importantly right now, the author of The Tragedy Test, Making Sense of Life-Changing Loss, A Rabbi's Journey, an incredible story. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish, Rich.
Hi, Sam. Thank you so much, John. My honor to be here with you.
I always hate to bring you back through this, but of course you've done this extensively, first in creating the Tali Fund and the project in Africa, and now in this really beautiful and I think extraordinarily helpful book. Tell us what prompted the creation of the Tragedy Test.
Well, you know, people undergo tragedy. It happens every day somewhere around the world to someone. And in tragedy, people turn to faith, that whatever their faith may be, they need comfort and they need answers. Sometimes they get them and sometimes they don't. And when we suffered our terrible loss, our 26-year-old daughter Talia, struck and killed by a motor vehicle while jogging, all of a sudden I realized that the answers I knew, and I'm a rabbi, weren't really adequate, weren't really enough to give me what I needed in the wake of tragedy, my personal tragedy.
Now, in the face of this unimaginable loss, even though we as rabbis know many people who have lost children, unfortunately, we have colleagues and friends who have lost children, we don't think it's happening to us. When it happens, people say all kinds of things. Are any of them really helpful?
Well, there are a lot of things that aren't helpful, that's for sure. Maybe words, it's good to appreciate that words aren't always the best response here. Sometimes very simply, a hug, an embrace, an expression of love or concern or caring, that's really usually the best thing to do. If you find you absolutely must say something, I've kind of come to realize that the best words might well be, I can't imagine. Because in fact, you can't. Even if you've undergone something similar, it's not the same for anyone, for any two people, any two tragedies, to put it in that terrible way. But I can't imagine. And that's really maybe as good a set of words as you can offer.
In the course of, now it's been 7 years since Talia's tragic loss, and Talia was a wonderful young adult, I think anybody who knew her would say that, with a great future ahead of her. 7 years is a long time. There's no amount of years that's really enough, is there?
It's hard to say. Time does heal a little bit. And time gives us an opportunity to put things in perspective. I wrote the book really for my own therapy. I had those questions, as I mentioned. You know, how did this happen? Why did this happen? What God is behind all this, really? And the act of writing enabled me to process all of those questions. And I'm definitely in a better place emotionally, spiritually, than I was 7 years ago, when we were really, of course, just blindsided and rocked on so many different levels. And, you know, there's a saying that that which is most personal is most universal. And I was able to, you know, translate my own personal journey and that of my family. And it seems from the initial response to the book that other people are able to gain some strength and support from it as well.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Richard Agler about his extraordinary book, The Tragedy Test, which has just been published, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue relocated to the Catalina foothills, is celebrating its first services, classes, and events this winter. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, Friday night and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills. We are thrilled to announce Beit Simcha's new home, 3001 East Skyline Drive, on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, across from La Encantada. Services, classes, events, all are held here this winter and spring. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell, Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning at 9 a.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services and adult education academy courses and religious school, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, speaking to us not from the One Tribe Israel Center, but from his car in Israel. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. Israel time, almost Laila Tov.
Almost Laila Tov for you. It's snowing in Jerusalem, and so it's midwinter there, and so naturally you have a cold. So I want to join everybody in the Two Jewish Listening Audience in wishing you a refuah shlema.
Thank you so much.
You are in Israel right now interviewing Shin Shinim, which are, of course, the wonderful representatives, young representatives of Israel. Tell us about that process, how it works, what your experience is.
Yeah, so about 2,700 applicants, or even 3,000 this year, applied in order to serve the Jewish community outside of Israel. And they applied through the Jewish Agency, who screened them and trained them. We, as Tucson, had the honor of meeting seven of them, three outstanding young men, and four amazing young ladies.
It's too bad you can't take them all, huh?
That's true, yeah. And so the interview was held in our partnership region, which is Chof Ashkelon, and I was the community representative. And then there were two from our partnership here in Israel. And then there was one from the Jewish Agency. And we met them each for a minimum of 30 minutes, where we, ahead of time, received their bios and, you know, evaluation, things that they either need to work on or things that they're just amazing at. And before I actually departed to Israel, I met with all site supervisors in our community to ask them, what is it that you're looking for? So we can do, you know, the best job that we can. And the interview started by sincerely thanking them because they volunteer. They're going to postpone their life by 1 year, where all their friends, or the majority of their friends, are going to go to the IDF. And if they don't pass our interviews, then they're going to offer themselves to other Jewish communities around the world, not just North America. So I obviously, after the interview, sent a summary of what I thought to my colleagues back in Tucson. I am flying back to the States after Shabbat, And then the first few days that I'm going to be in Tucson, I'm going to meet and share again and hear the inputs. And then we're going to select two. And we have to be fair and make sure that we let them know as soon as possible so they'll know either to wait for us or to go to other communities or just to go to the Army.
So it's a huge interview process. It's kind of like speed dating at first, obviously, and then you get to know them better. And then you have the opportunity to bring them, 9,000 miles away to a brand new community. What an incredible experience.
Yeah. And what we do is, we look for English skills, of course.
Of course.
Strong English skills. But that's not the first and only thing. So the interview is held both in English and in Hebrew. In Hebrew because it's their first language, so we can feel free and get to know them in a better way. And what we did was we asked them, our questions and then actually shared scenarios that were written by former Shinshinim all around the country.
Yeah, what happens so if you're in this circumstance? What would you do? I think that's great.
Right.
Amir, I'm sorry, but we're running out of time, and we will talk to you next week, and we can't wait to meet the new Shinshinim, although we like the Shinshiniyot we have now, too.
Right, absolutely.
Thanks so much. Absolutely. Listen, Refuah Shleima and Nesia Tova.
Toda rabba. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You are just back from a trip. What an unusual thing to say. A trip to Argentina. And you have a story or two to share.
Right. So I went to Mendoza, where I have a lot of good friends, almost all of whom are related to the wine industry. Mendoza is de facto the capital of all South American wines, although it's possible that Chilean wines are better known because they're generally cheaper. Even the National Airlines of Chile in first and business class mostly serves Argentinian wines, not Chilean wines. So it's a nod to the truth. I always knew that Mendoza had a small Jewish community. The lead car dealership there is Goldstein. And
sounds pretty Jewish to me.
There's a couple of different synagogues. What I didn't know, and in fact still don't know because my Spanish is woefully inadequate, is to what degree they have an Orthodox Jewish community. And here's one of two interesting stories that I want to share with you and your listeners. So my preferred way to get to Mendoza, where I've gone quite often, as you know, is to fly to Santiago de Chile and then just hop over the Andes. It's like the flight between Tucson and Phoenix. It's like a 25, 30-minute flight. You basically have to go up and down. But it's spectacularly beautiful because you fly through jagged peaks. In fact, not even over them, but through passageways where you're surrounded by peaks. It's quite impressive. So on this short flight from Santiago de Chile to Mendoza, there was an unaccompanied minor, a boy of roughly 10 years old, give or take, wearing a kippah, tzitziot, and the beginnings of Pes. So clearly an Orthodox kid.
Obviously.
And I don't know whether he and his family live in Santiago de Chile or in Mendoza. And I didn't know enough Spanish to ask him where he actually lives, but he was flying alone. So he's either flying to relatives or from relatives. And I asked around among my friends who were pretty cosmopolitan and from several different nations, like France, England, Australia, U.S., Argentina, whatever. It's the wine community there is quite international. I said, is there an Orthodox community here? And the guy who seemed surest of his answer said, yeah, there's only about 100 or 120 super Orthodox people, but there are this sort of fringe population, which even the Jewish communities consider sort of fringe. And it made me think about an issue that we've discussed before on your show, which is the extent to which there's growing polarization between Orthodox Jews or ultra-Orthodox Jews and the rest of world Jewry, whether they call themselves Reform, Reconstructionist, Progressive, Conservative, whatever, they are not Orthodox. And you know, it's interesting that even in a tiny Jewish community like Mendoza, there's an extreme fringe and a sort of mainstream Jewish community, even if altogether that's only 500 people.
Really? Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's not a surprise. We know how, you know, two Jews, three opinions, four synagogues, six rabbis is kind of a stereotype. But even in Mendoza, Argentina, you can find those kinds of subdivisions. Thanks, Tom. We will continue this next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sarah comes home from the Peace Corps in Uganda and surprises her mother, Sadie, who's about to light Friday night Shabbos candles. Sadie is thrilled. She can't stop hugging Sarah. Finally, she says, with a kiss, "Sit down, darling. Tell me about all that you were doing there in Uganda." And Sarah says, "Mom, I got big news. I got married while I was in Africa." "Oy," says Sadie, "how could you do that without even telling me?" "Well," Sarah answers, "I found a guy who was just the kind of man you always told me to marry, so I didn't wait." Sadie asks, "What's he like? Where is he?" "He's waiting outside the door," her daughter answers. "Bring him in," says Sadie. "I want to meet my new son-in-law." Sarah opens the door. Sadie sees a big, tattooed African man wearing a feathered codpiece, ornate headdress, animal tooth beads, and a ceremonial mask, holding a long spear. So Sadie turns to her daughter and says, "You idiot. I said marry a rich doctor." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniyot, our representatives of Israel, for the Weintraub Israel Center, doing their Shnat Sherut, their year of service here in America. Ron Benekot and Rotem Rappaport. It's almost Tu B'Shvat tonight and tomorrow, which is such an unusual holiday for American Jews. Most of them don't even know what it is. The New Year for trees. What do? They plant trees in Israel or something. Tell us about your experience of Tu B'Shvat Baretz, in the land of Israel.
Okay, so in my village, my moshav in Israel, we have this kind of festival we do on Tu B'Shvat. We go on bicycles and we go on a trip, and then we go somewhere and we plant trees. And after that, we go to the forest and we do this big festival, and people do picnics and do lunches, and people just like hang out together, and they have Omega, they have a zip line.
What you guys call zip line is Omega in Israel. That's such a funny and different name for
right.
So is that everywhere, or is it just Rotem's nutty moshav that does this for Tu B'Shvat?
It's everywhere. A lot of people go and plant trees and have different festivals, and we always have dried fruits, you know.
Lots and lots of dried fruits,
right? A lot of
all the Shiva Taminim, all the seven species of the land of Israel.
And it's always a lot of fun.
Pomegranates and figs and so on.
Right. It's always just a lot of fun because it just... being with family and friends and taking care of your environments and Israel and the land. And it's really fun. I like this day.
Are there other conservation efforts? I mean, I think conservation in Israel, it's probably a really good topic today since it's close to Tu B'Shvat. You know, ecological conservation has become so much more a conscious act in Israel than it used to be. Used to be Israel was a place where people threw their litter on the ground and the Yarkon was toxic, you know, the river, and not like that so much anymore, right?
I guess we still have a place for improvement. I guess the Yarkon is still not a good place to swim in.
Yeah, I don't think I'd go swimming there, personally.
Yeah, it's not. And actually, the thing is, I think, is that they have a lot of... campaigns for cleaning the beaches in Israel because we have a very long coastline, and people
coastline, by the way.
Yeah, beautiful. And a lot of people litter it and make it just a bad place to be, and it's really sad. So I think there's a lot of campaigns right now that is going for cleaning the beaches and doing big events for doing that. And also we have a lot of places that people love to go on trips, and a lot of picnic places that are beautiful and also people literate. There's a lot of campaigns for that as well.
Well, it's nice to know. This is a good time of year, Tu B'Shvat, to remember the environment and how important it is to care for it and to take care of it and to protect it.
Right.
It says in Bereshit, it's our job, right? We're the stewards of the earth. Yeah. Thanks so much. Chag Sameach.
Thank you. Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. Can you recite the Ten Commandments by heart? I suspect not. Most of us can't. We usually remember thou shalt not murder, often misstated as thou shalt not kill, and thou shalt not steal. Most people remember there's something in there about honoring father and mother and not swearing. Others get the adultery part, or perhaps even the Sabbath. Few people remember all Ten Commandments. But whether we know them by heart or not, these 10 statements from this week's portion of Yitro are supposed to be the only words God ever spoke directly to our people. But they are not really at the heart of our Judaism today. Why not? In point of fact, we liberal or progressive Jews have trouble with many of the 10, struggle to find relevant ways to observe them. Nearly every commandment brings a problem, even the most positively phrased. What does it mean to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy if we spend most of Shabbat working? I recall attending a Reform Movement convention in Toronto a few years ago, a biennial, hearing Rabbi Eric Yaffe, a past guest of Two Jewish, thank the delegates at services for celebrating a non-wired Shabbat, free of iPhones. His remarks were immediately posted on Facebook by many of the delegates using the same smartphones they were supposed to have put away for the Shabbos. Nearly all of the commandments have complications. How are we to suitably honor our fathers and mothers if they are challenging people or even abusive? Not murdering or stealing seems clear enough, but how can we possibly avoid being jealous of our neighbor's better job or nicer car? And don't we take God's name in vain all the time without apparent repercussion? I believe the commandment we have the gravest difficulty observing among Reform, liberal, conservative, reconstructionist, progressive, and all the other non-Orthodox Jews may actually be the first one. It's the simple statement that there is a God who commands us at all. Classically, this first statement, which contains no apparent commandment, has been considered by Christians a kind of preamble to the Ten Commandments, but we Jews have always insisted on viewing it as a unique and crucial statement. Why? It is because as logical as the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments may seem as a declaration of ethics, if we do not accept the existence of a commander, a mitzvah in Hebrew, well, the Ten Commandments essentially lose their power. With no mitzvah, no commander, there is no mitzuveh, no recipient of the command. And in practical terms, there are no real commandments, no mitzvot to be kept at all. The warrant for the authority of the Ten Commandments is in this simple statement, Anochi Adonai Elohecha, God exists, acts, commands. It is why they are not called the Ten Suggestions, or the Ten Recommendations, or the 10 nice ideas, if you can, you know, handle them. It is only when we accept the existence of God, when we diminish our own elaborate sense of self, that we are able to partner with God to create a moral world. Only when we engage with the commander do we find the commandments. It's up to us, on this week of Parshat Yitro, to find for ourselves the one who commanded them. However we conceive of the Holy One, to accept our role as recipients of ethical commandment. When we choose to do so, we will find that we can then be moral beings. We can shape this world in good ways and observe the Ten Commandments just as they were intended to be observed. By heart. From the heart, that is. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Rich Agler, who has explored tragedy on a personal level, will tell us all about the tragedy test and how it can help us grow in our own lives. Meet him again when we come back on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel supplied weapons to Syrian rebels in the Golan Heights. Outgoing Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff Gadi Eiskanot said just last week. This marks the first time an Israeli official has acknowledged that Israel gave the rebels anything more than humanitarian aid. The comments were reported in an exit interview with Eiskanot speaking to the London Times. He stepped down last week. Eiskanot told the reporter that Israel provided Syrian rebel groups with light weapons for, quote-unquote, self-defense. His comments were published the same day that Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu acknowledged Israel has struck targets in Syria. "We carried out thousands of attacks without taking responsibility, without asking for credit in recent years," Eiskanot also said. Foreign Policy magazine reported back in September, citing rebel commanders and foot soldiers, that Israel had secretly armed and funded at least 12 rebel groups in southern Syria that helped prevent Iran-backed fighters and Iranian terrorists from taking positions near the Israeli border in recent years. This news should come as no surprise to anyone who's followed the events of the Syrian civil war and understands the complexity of the changing alliances and the incredible brutality of both Bashar al-Assad and ISIS and their Russian and Iranian allies, respectively. In lighter news, the famed Nathan Al's Jewish Deli in Beverly Hills, a Hollywood landmark where film stars and studio executives mingled over lox and eggs, where Larry King famously ate every day for years. Nathan Al's has been in financial trouble since last year. Owners David and Mark Mendelson were close to selling the 73-year-old institution. Larry King told The Hollywood Reporter last March if Lou Wasserman, the legendary agent and studio exec, were alive today, he'd buy Nathan Al's. But Wasserman died in 2002, alas. It seemed the deli was about to do the same. The problem was that Nathan Al's was housed in a 5,200-square-foot building in the middle of Beverly Hills worth, if not more, $25 million. Nobody's going to put up that much cash to run a deli, not even one where a pastrami sandwich runs $18. Riding to the rescue, music mogul Irving Azoff, Billboard magazine's most powerful person in the music industry in 2012, and his wife Shelley, a marketing executive, the couple got agent and United Talent Agency co-president Jay Suris, Universal Film Entertainment Group chair Jeffrey Schell, real estate developer Michael Meldman, and nightlife entrepreneur Randy Gerber and his model wife Cindy Crawford to join in the effort to save Nathan Al's. That group turned down the Mendelsons' offer to buy the building, opting instead to purchase just the business and relocate Nathan Al's. The latest rumor that the Azoffs are considering several locations, including one in nearby Brentwood. Nathan Al's was nearly as iconic in Beverly Hills as the Carnegie Deli was in Manhattan. Of course, that closed and moved too, so perhaps Nathan Al's can also.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat, or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Actress Carol Channing, who originated the starring role in Hello, Dolly! On Broadway and won a Tony for her portrayal of the boisterous widow, died last week at the age of 97. Daughter of a Jewish mother and Christian father, Carol Channing identified herself as part Jewish. She wrote in her memoir of her five-year marriage to her first of four husbands, Theodore Nadish, that she learned to speak fluent Yiddish from his grandfather, Sam Cohen, who lived in Brooklyn's Brighton Beach. The Seattle native first became a star by playing flapper Lorelei Lee in the 1949 production of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, where she sang the iconic "Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend."
Hello, Harry, well, hello, Louie, it's so nice to be back home where I belong. You're looking swell, Manny, I can tell. Danny, you're still glowing, you're still crowing, you're still going strong. I feel the room swaying, for the band's playing one of my old favorite songs from way back when. So bridge that gap, fellas, find me an empty lap, fellas, Dolly, I'll never go away again.
Carol Channing played Dolly in Hello, Dolly, winning the Tony in 1964, and kept playing her, eventually playing the role for the last time in a 1995 revival. Barbara Streisand was Dolly in the 69 film version. Bette Midler also won a Tony Award for her portrayal in the 2017 Broadway revival. Quite a Jewish role to win a Tony, huh? Channing was recognized with a Lifetime Achievement Tony Award in 1995, was inducted into the American Theater Hall of Fame in 81. She made guest appearances on many television shows, including Sesame Street, where she performed a parody of Hello, Dolly. Carol Channing was unique, and I'm afraid Dolly has finally gone away one last time. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Richard Agler. He's the author of the new book, The Tragedy Test, Making Sense of Life-Changing Loss, A Rabbi's Journey. Rich, a point of personal privilege. I know, because I heard you speak about the book, and of course I've known you a long time, that originally this book might have been, I don't know, 400 or 500 pages, you know, when it first came out of you. That's therapy. That's not a book that helps other people necessarily. Tell me about that transition, just that sort of author's journey.
Well, my way of coping with difficulties and problems and issues for many, many years has been to write. That's actually a good thing for a congregational rabbi. We get to, you know, kind of process and share our thoughts on all sorts of complex matters, you know, from the pulpit with our congregations. And that was really the way that I had become accustomed to dealing with difficult issues. And this was certainly a difficult, and some weeks or months, I don't remember exactly, after Talia's death, I sat down to write, and I really just poured everything that I had into the computer. When I stopped, I felt that it was, you know, 80,000 words later, about 350 pages that would have been, and I realized that I had a book there. I didn't necessarily know that when I sat down to write, but I did. I felt at the end. And this is a story I tell now that Mark Twain once said to a friend of his, "I'm sending you a long letter. I don't have time to write a short one." I had a short one. I had time to write a short or a shorter book. And through, you know, a lot of careful editing and rewriting and reconstructing, I was able to, you know, cut the book in half, so it's a more manageable 40,000 words. It's written really for a general audience. People shouldn't be afraid of the topic. Oh, there's going to be too much high-level academic theology. There, it's in there, but it's really in a very accessible and clear language, if I might say so.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. One of the really fascinating parts about this is you go through, in the course of it, the kind of answers that people give, and the kind of answers that, that you would have given as a rabbi, the kind of answers that you would have thought of in your experience, and, I don't know, essentially reject them each. Tell me about that.
Well, there are a lot of things that people say. I would not have necessarily said them as a rabbi, but they're kind of woven into, you know, the theology, not only of Judaism, but of Christianity and Islam and other faiths as well. Maybe about the most popular one or the most well-known is that the very simple phrase that lots of people say and we hear very frequently, namely, everything happens for a reason. Okay, and, you know, people say, well, you know, there's a conflict, there's something difficult, there was something problem, there was a tragedy even. And sometimes people look to offer comfort by saying, well, I believe everything happens for a reason. And people are well-meaning when they say that. But the implication of that is that there is someone who orchestrated this, someone who felt that it was necessary for this to happen. In other words, God, that God is somehow making these things happen. And to say that God has taken my daughter or anyone's child or any other tragic occurrence and saying, God is giving us this, well, that's a really very painful kind of a God to be in relationship with. And it's one, frankly, that I and I know other people have rejected. God is supposed to be loving. God is supposed to be caring and supportive, not cruel and vindictive and abusive. And when we say things even as simple as that, you know, well, I believe everything happens for a reason, it's implicating God. It's saying that, well, God is the one who's doing this. I don't know why or how, but God is doing it nonetheless. And that's a very, very dangerous theological place to go. And we probably shouldn't go there so much.
The other answer, well, one of the other things that people often say is, well, no one is ever given more than they can handle.
Yeah. Again, it's the same kind of idea, that God is giving us these burdens. And if, again, that's a very difficult God to be in relationship with. You know, again, God is supposed to be there to help us, to guide us, to direct us, to love us, to say God is throwing these things at us. You know, a lot of times these things, those sayings like that can work in the sense that they can be sometimes helpful and comforting if the issue in question is maybe mild to moderate in severity. You know, I twisted my ankle. Well, everything happens for a reason. You know, we can maybe learn from this, we can heal right from this, and, you know, so on and so forth. But when the stakes are higher, it's really an absurd, you know, kind of a thing. You know, I'm sorry your child has cancer, but I believe everything happens for a reason. I mean, it's absurd on the face of it. And so when we think these things through, you know, we realize that maybe that's no; those aren't the best things to say, and more importantly, to believe.
I want to talk about belief a little bit. You're a rabbi. Not all rabbis have strong belief, unfortunately, perhaps.
I'll leave that to you.
But a lot of us do, certainly. This is the kind of event that certainly challenges belief. It challenges our preconceptions. That life is going on fine and lots of things are good, and then something horrific happens. Tell us about your faith journey, your own faith journey in this experience.
Well, yeah, I had a long-standing relationship with God. It was a relationship with God, or a caring about God, or a desire to understand God that led me into the rabbinate when I was a young man. I had felt and believed and experienced, if I could say, that God was really with me all along the journey. No matter what I did, you know, whether it was serve a congregation or found a congregation at one point, a devoted husband and father and friend, the charitable work that I've done, the social justice kinds of projects that, you know, I and others have undertaken. So we do good things in God's name, inspired by God's teachings. And we feel that our faith and our relationship with God are strong. And then all of a sudden, yeah, something calamitous can happen, and we throw everything into question. And I think this is a normal thing, you know, and I think it's something that a lot of people wonder about. People not only undergo their own personal tragedies at times, but they see tragedies all over the world. We're all plugged into the media. There's not a day goes by when we don't learn about on the local news or on the national news or on the international news about tragedies happening. And people wonder, what kind of God is behind all this? How is this, these things happen? We're taught as children, and, you know, the Bible has a narrative in it, that God, you know, takes care of the good people and punishes the wicked. And yet, there seems to be too many times when life does not seem to unfold that way. And this makes us question this, you know.
So you questioned, you had to question, and you go through in your book many of the kinds of experiences you had in doing that questioning. So now a nasty question from me, where did you come out?
Well, I came, it's not a nasty question at all, but I came to understand that the God who, you know, I currently believe in, I call the God of law and spirit. Really fairly simple what to think about it. Law, well, the universe is linked together and knit together by laws, from the cosmos down to the subatomic particles within us and within everything. There are laws there, and we can't live in contradistinction, or we can't live in opposition to those laws. Those laws have the final word about everything in life. In my case, or Talia's case, when a young woman, a slender young girl, is struck by a motor vehicle traveling at speed while she's jogging, well, the laws are going to be what the laws are, and we can't really pretend otherwise. We can't really claim otherwise. What else would we expect to happen when something like that happens? As far as why it happens, well, you can say, well, God wanted it to happen, and to me, that's simply obscene. I know that's a strong word, but God is a God of justice. Talia committed no capital offense. Why should her life be taken? So maybe it's not God who was behind it at all. These are simply the laws of the universe, the laws of physics, the laws of nature that took her life. And to accept that, it also kind of has a corollary to it, that God is limited, that God does not kind of come down and is not a marionette master or puppeteer, you know, moving things in and out for his purposes. There's just too much injustice in the world for us to credibly claim that. And it becomes very clear when we experience a tragedy personally. Prior to this, I could understand all these things. You know, you can have lots of different answers to these kinds of questions. And rabbis, as you know, have lots of answers. And we know lots of ways of responding to these kinds of questions. But when it hits you personally, well, a lot of those answers really don't cut it. They may seem academic. They may seem or less or worse or punitive or just whatever they might be. They're just not adequate.
I want to thank Rabbi Rich Agler for an incredible visit here on Too Jewish. I feel like we could go on for a long time. His new book is called The Tragedy Test, Making Sense of Life-Changing Loss, A Rabbi's Journey. I think it's helpful for anyone, but in particular anyone who has suffered a loss. Rich, where can people go to find out more about it?
Yeah, the best place to go really is tragedytest.com. I've got a short introductory video there. You can place an order there. We'll send it right out to you. It's really the best thing to do. We appreciate when people buy books from authors, from the authors directly. And again, a portion of the proceeds of every sale will go to the Tally Fund to promote awareness for organ donation and to really support the charitable work in Talia's name that continues to really rescue and save lives in Africa.
Incredible mission. Thank you so much, Rich. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Rabbi Daniel Freelander, president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, the parent organization for all Reform and Progressive congregations in the entire world. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website, Top 10 in America. Our playout this morning is from Israeli singer Idan Reichel. His song, the Im Tavoi Eli, if you will come to me. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
מבטיח שאף פעם לא תהי לבד, ואם פתאום תעלמי אחכה כל הלילה ואלחש בתפילה שאליי תחזרי. ואם תבואי אליי נשאר כל הלילה ואלחש לך מילים שתדעי שאני שלך, ובבוקר תראי נשאר ביחד, הולכים את הדרך הזו לתמיד יד ביד. כל הלילה
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.